Welcome, everyone, to the 2015-2016 season of the Football Scholars Forum. It is a real pleasure to welcome one of our very own to this inaugural session, Dr. Christoph Wagner now, who freshly completed his PhD in history at De Montfort University with a thesis entitled Crossing the Line, the English Press and Anglo-German Football, 1954 to 1996. So, as is customary, we will let Christoph kick things off with a few comments, maybe about the project, some of the motivations or some of the challenges, some of the lessons learned, however you want to go, Christoph. And then we'll open up the field for questions, and we can use the instant messaging function on Skype perhaps as a virtual queue. Okay, so without further ado, let's turn it over to Christoph and welcome everybody on three different continents to this session.
Okay, hello. Thanks, Peter. As Peter said, this thesis is just was accepted by De Montfort University in April, and I'm quite pleased that it actually went ahead quite quickly with everything concerning the Viva and everything, and the amendments that I had to do. And I'm even more pleased to be able to speak here today at the Football Scholar Forum about my project. How did it come about, this thesis, or how did the topic evolve? I actually don't know exactly how, when it started or how it started. It was a series of discussions that I had with my first supervisor, Professor De Porter at De Montfort University, where we found out that we had the similar interest in how the media reported on sports and how the media, and since I was in England as a guest, as a German, and I obviously had a different view on how the English media reported on sport and other things that the German media, for instance, reported differently on. So this was the kind of the initial discussion that evolved from there, that we thought, hang on, maybe we can do something, or you could do something about football, about that, from that interest that you have. And from those discussions, I think we discussed that about a year before I actually started the research and the writing of it. And so having then set out the idea of analyzing newspaper reports of matches between England and Germany in the second half of the 20th century, the project itself evolved while I was actually writing it. I was not having, I did not lay out a plan that I wanted to have, that I wanted to do it that way in a certain manner throughout the thesis. It evolved. I initially planned to look at how, for instance, the club game was reported on, because that's. But then I decided not to, because that's a lot more material, and secondly, it's an entirely different discussion. So I focused entirely on the national teams from 1954 to 1996, and you might wonder why I choose that particular time frame. Before 1950, Germany or West Germany then was not allowed to participate in international sport events, and the first international game between England and Germany came in 1954. So that was the first game after the end of the Second World War, after 1945, and choosing the end point, the European Championship in 1996 in England again, was a technical matter. It was the internet was already, or the newspapers had already their web pages up and running, but they were not as the focus was still on print and not on online reading, and therefore that was a reasonable time frame to end it. And of course, it was this, the 20th century. So after that, there are only games in the new millennium. But that is a different technical matter as well, because we have then first social networks, we have online media, probably the reporting and the writing about football, and from then on entirely changed. So that was the reason why I've chosen that time frame. So that was the genesis and how it came about. As an introduction, that was for me, that was it so far. I'm very happy to discuss it with you, answer your questions, whatever.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Who would like to go first then?
I maybe have a quick speculative question, but you address this a little bit in your conclusion, and you name some actors even. I'm thinking of Piers Morgan on Twitter, but how do you think you would approach integrating the post-millennium sources into this narrative and, you know, everything from the practical aspects to what it would do to kind of the analysis? So just an opportunity for you to speculate on how you would take that chunk of time on. I'm really interested in the methods discussion, particularly.
Yeah, I think that's very, very difficult, very different. There's a lot. You have to scan very thoroughly any kind of Twitter discussion before or after those games, and I think that's a lot more time consuming than it was now. Now, even reading newspaper articles from 40 years, from two countries, six newspapers, that was already time-consuming. It took 7 years to do it in total. And I think doing that on Twitter, for instance, where everything is very quick, but it's also gone very quickly, it's a... You need a particular online archive almost to save those tweets, those little messages of 140 characters. That's very, very difficult. Facebook or other social networks are certainly easier to handle, because I suppose it's a bit more... this is a bigger longevity in those than in Twitter. Twitter is very almost just for the moment, and I think that'll be very difficult. The other thing then would also be blogs. Some blogs run for a couple of years, 1 year. Some run longer. My blog is now running in this sixth year, so. Again, it's a question of how long such media actually exist, how long they are around, how long are these people writing on those. Some people just lose interest, don't do it anymore, and or websites completely disappear. So it is a very... The method would be very different, and it would be time-consuming, but in a different way. Probably more time-consuming than just reading printed newspapers or online articles.
Thanks for that. Yeah, it definitely sounds daunting. And you know, if you're curious, and you may even know about them, I can send you some models for grabbing data off of Twitter and Facebook. Twitter is kind of to get access to the fire hose, so to speak. You can get around that in certain ways you can create like a Google spreadsheet that tracks by hashtag, but then, you know, you'd have to decide what hashtags you want to track. And, you know, it'd be really fascinating, though, to try and develop a kind of methodology to get it, maybe tracking patterns of the kinds of terms that you track throughout the chapters, on how people are referring to one another, and, you know, if it's moving away from maybe the newspaper space or the daily space that someone like Piers Morgan was using, and if it's more in the Twitter sphere, it'd be really interesting to track that. But thanks for your response.
Oh, surely. I'd be very interesting to have an idea how to track further material in, obviously, that research isn't finished, and maybe one day I'll have a go at a second part of the, yeah.
Great. We have two people lined up, but I just want to intervene very, very briefly to say that listening to you speak about the impact of new technologies on, you know, sort of press and media coverage of football today raises lots of questions about how historians in, say, 20 years are going to be able to do the kind of meticulous, painstaking research you did in this thesis, because, you know, these social media, these blogs tend to disappear or are not preserved very well or are difficult to access. So something to ponder. But the next question will come from Stephen, and then we have Chris Brown.
Thank you so much, Peter. Thank you, Christoph. A very interesting study. I didn't really get the chance to read it because I'm really sick. I will this weekend. I was hoping to see a index at the end, and the reason for that is I was wondering if you speak about, if you try to relate your study to the movies, because I think that in the movies the Germans were the bad guys for a few decades that were replaced after that by Soviets and probably nowadays by Middle Eastern characters, and for a while the Germans were the bad guys on the pitch as well. So have you ever thought about that? And is there anything about movies? And do you relate your study in any way to this other aspect of popular culture?
I must admit, I have not watched any movie that relates to England, Germany, and football. If you like the one, what's it called? The one with Sylvester Stallone and Peter Bobby Moore.
Victory.
Victory.
That's the one. Yeah, I haven't seen that. And obviously, that's a very interesting thing to do. I haven't really looked into popular culture or films, movies as a topic for representation of national stereotypes or even national identity. That'd be very interesting because obviously you mentioned it. For a long time, there have been the Germans as the ultimate baddies, so to say, the bad guys, and except one, that was Hardy Krüger. he was the one. He got away. One got away. I think that was the film. But yeah, particularly in British films, the Germans are portrayed in a negative way for quite a long time, and now. Since the end of the Cold War, even the Germans are, well, still seen as suspects, but the Russians are the ultimate evil now. Well, that's a good point, actually. It's a very good point.
Okay, Chris.
Thank you so much, Christoph.
Okay, it's Chris here. Thanks very much, Christoph, for sharing your work. In my own work, I use newspapers a lot, as many of us do, and I'm finding myself increasingly sympathetic towards the journalists who are producing our sources. And this is something that came up in our previous FSF discussion about perhaps we academics give journalists a hard time sometimes, not taking into account their deadlines, how quickly they're having to write their pieces, and the various influences upon them. And I just wondered whether I couldn't see all that much sort of biographical information about the key journalists that you were using, and I wondered whether that was something that interested you. You know, charting the progress over time, changing attitudes from individual journalists, you know, what is the power that these figures have, and if there was anything else that, you know, that you found of interest in that regard.
During my Viva, I was asked by Chris Boltzmann, who unfortunately can't be with us today, about one particular sports journalist that was Desmond Hackett, because throughout the first two chapters on the 50s and the 60s, Desmond Hackett was a very prominent figure in the British sports journalism. And it was him and his colleague, Peter Wilson, who placed himself at the center of the story, and to that way became almost authoritative figures in the reporting on football for, yeah, the two post-war decades. I don't know how much longer they've been working on football before. And I'm sure their background is essentially British. They've been brought up in the later decades of the British Empire, and they had a natural suspicion towards the Germans after the First World War, and even more so after the Second World War, even though in the 60s the Germans were rather seen, still as the ultimate bunny on the football pitch, but essentially politically they were their allies, because the ultimate evil then was the Soviet Union, and Germany and Britain were co-war allies. It'd be interesting to see what was their background. I actually haven't done any further research into their personal background, i.e. upbringing, education, if they had any education at all, if they were involved in fighting in the First World War or in Spain or in India or wherever they were, could have been involved in fighting. So the biographical aspect for these people is very interesting, and in a way that shapes their reporting on how they see Germany on a football pitch.
Thanks, Christoph. Yep.
Okay, at this point, maybe I don't see anyone in the virtual queue, so I'll ask a question, because it kind of rides on what Chris just asked, and that is, I was really impressed by how carefully and systematically you went through the newspaper archives, mainly, of course, in the UK, but also towards the end in Chapter 5 in the German context. Yet I didn't see any oral history interviews, particularly with journalists, such as, you know, those who shaped the coverage that you were analyzing. And, you know, you do mention at the beginning in the introduction how Geoffrey Hill, of course, who you know very well, you know, has talked about the importance of seeing press sources as more than just sources of information, but as essentially constructed texts. So if you had the chance to interview some of these reporters, what might they have revealed that the public transcript, if you want to call it that, of their reporting that we get in the archives now did not? And maybe share some insights on maybe why you didn't go the route of oral history. Thank you.
What would they reveal about the way they work? Is that what you, or the way they reported on those games? Was that your question, Peter?
Yes, and also some of the issues you just raised in responding to Chris's question about, you know, their background, their education, their inclination, perhaps their ideological positions and biases and etc.
I doubt that, for instance, if I had the chance to interview Desmond Hackett, for instance, that he'd be very different in his manner towards me, particularly me, since I'm German. So if I had a chance in the 50s as a scholar to interview him about Anglo-German relationships, I think he would even be more patronizing, and I don't know, but that's my opinion from what I've come to read from him, what he's written. Likewise, I think that if I could interview Piers Morgan, for instance, about this 1996 coverage of his newspaper, the Daily Mirror, then he would probably just hide behind the placate and say, "Well, that was just humor. If you don't get it, it's your fault. It's your loss." I think maybe there'd be some little bit of him saying, "Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe I crossed the line, or maybe I just went a bit too far, one step too far." Oral history, why have I not included it? First of all, I think it's also a technical matter. I think it's a cheap excuse, but I'm hiding behind the word limit of 80,000 words, and I exceeded that a bit. And I think had I included oral material, that would have been even more. That doesn't mean it's not to be. It could have been done. Yes, that's true. But I haven't, and I have decided against it. And in the end, since I came up to more than 80,000 words, it was probably the right decision not to add this into the thesis.
Okay, thank you. Maybe we can come back to some of these issues later. Let's go to Daniel in Beirut, yes?
Yes, I'm in Beirut. Can you hear me?
Perfectly.
Perfect. Yeah, perfect. Hallo, Christoph.
Hallo.
Since there are two Germans, we need to talk at least one word in German. I wrote on Twitter a couple of minutes ago that my favorite quote as a German from the dissertation is a Guardian headline before the 2014 World Cup, "Whisper it softly, it's okay to like Germany." Is this more like the intellectual perspective, or was like also in the other English media, like the tabloid media, like The Sun, did the tone also change significantly there? I would be interested in that. And then you mentioned in your brief introduction, I think you mentioned that the coach Klopp, that he's now the coach from Liverpool, and I think there was a lot of euphoria when he arrived. Would you say this is maybe like the final like normalization of like English, the German perception in the English media, that there was so much euphoria? And maybe the last thing, I think, it's not the first. You mentioned Trautmann in your work, and I mean, there were like other Germans like Klinsmann. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit like German players were perceived in England. I remember that Klinsmann, I think, was like, people said he is like a king of diving, etc., when he arrived. But I think then at the end, people loved him. But maybe you can elaborate this a little bit, like German players in England.
Coming back to your first thought about the Guardian headline, yeah, I was actually surprised to read that myself when I. But I think it wasn't. It is not surprising to see that in the Guardian, in my opinion, because I think the Guardian is a very open-minded paper. People appear to be very, very educated. I don't know if that is an insult to anyone working at the Mail, the Mirror, Express, the Sun. But I do not expect. Or I would not have expected this in a paper like the Daily Mail. Whisper it softly. It's okay to like Germany. Secretly, the British have always admire Germany, or at least they liked Germany. They liked. If you read the way they talk about German football, they always talk about, yeah, it's efficient, it's no fussing about like the Italians or the Spanish, but Brazil, Argentina, they used to play a very direct game like England used to do, but Yeah, but Germany developed their own style of play, which is, yeah, simply very direct, very physical. That this was also not so productive in the late 1990s is was made very clear by the English press in 2000-2001. But the British also admired Germany, particularly in the 50s, 60s, 70s, for their economic development, particularly for the economic miracle that began in the 50s and only came to an end in the early 70s with the oil price crisis of 1973. And I think what accompanied the football coverage back then was also the kind of a bit of a debate about that the Germans actually worked harder, and automatically, as a result, had better living standard. That was the kind of essence the British drew from what they've seen when they were in Germany. When England came to Germany in 1956, all the press, the sports press, were absolutely blown away by what they saw in the training centre and how quickly Hanover had been rebuilt. So there is a certain admiration, though it's not very openly expressed. It's not saying, "Oh, we admire Germany." It's very subtle. It's just minor hints. And a few years ago, the British historian Dominic Sandbrook has made a video about German car manufacturing, and the British apparently they love German car manufacturing. If you watch Top Gear. Watch Top Gear when it was still going a few years ago. All three presenters, they admired German car making, not because the cars looked particularly good, but they were efficient. Everything that was in the car made sense and fulfilled the purpose. It was efficient, it worked well, it was quality work. And that, I think, that is it's well summarized in that headline. It's okay to like Germany, but it is also a development that kicked off in 2006, in particular when Germany hosted the World Cup. That even I was in England at the time, and I realized that the Germans were held in higher regard after the World Cup than they were held before, because all of a sudden Germany appeared to be a country where people actually can have a party, where they can be cheerful people who are easygoing, who are not thinkers and having to think all the time, but who are actually party people. And that's what particularly the English press liked about Germany in the new millennium after the World Cup 2006. And I'm turning to Klopp now. You asked me about Klopp. I personally feel that there was a bit of hype actually before when the news broke that he actually signed for Liverpool, would come to Liverpool and sign a contract, and it could go well for him as a coach, because he's a good coach. He has a very good track record with his previous club, Borussia Dortmund. So, and he likes to work with young players, and that's the case right now at Liverpool. So it could go well, but it could also be a disaster, like for instance with Felix Magath, who coached Fulham a few years ago, and that was an absolute disaster. Was that all your questions? Well, quite a few. Daniel?
You've dazzled him, Christoph.
Yeah, I probably dazzled everyone. Quite a lot.
Oh, he lost the connection, apparently. Are you back? Okay, someone else maybe can step in. Stephen, I see you very active there with the typing.
Hello.
I think Daniel is back.
Oh, Daniel, are you back?
Anyone who has not had the chance to ask a question yet, would you like to ask one now? Okay, if no one... Okay, go, Andrew.
Okay, I have a question that's not necessarily that from a historian. Since I'm not a historian, I'm curious some of the implications. I didn't read the whole thing very carefully, but it seemed to me that one of the cruxes was this notion of the war metaphor and its kind of ebbs and flows through various recent historical epochs. And as I was reading some of that stuff, it reminded me of some of the debates in kind of North American sports sociology about the militarization of sport and the various potential consequences of that. And I know this is not the purpose of the dissertation, but I'm curious if you think there are potential sort of abstract lessons about what sort of social, historical, cultural factors contribute to the militarization and the sort of the use of the war metaphor. Because if I understood correctly, part of what you're saying is that the English at a lot of points love this war metaphor and the Germans are kind of confused by it. It just doesn't seem appropriate. And along those lines, you know, if there are sort of lessons there for other sporting contexts around what does and doesn't influence the militarization of sport. And as kind of a second part of that, the other debate that happens in kind of North American sports sociology is about the actual effects of that war metaphor. Does it, because you could argue on the one hand that it either kind of trivializes war, it makes this representation that sport is the same as war and therefore, you know, war is not that big a deal. Like it's not that serious, even though it's a whole different order of magnitude. Or on the other hand, the other side of the argument is that it sort of glorifies war. It makes war seem sexy and seem, you know, alluring to young men in particular. And whether you have any sense of how that metaphor has actually functioned in, I guess it would be in particularly in English culture over time. Hope that makes sense.
Hello.
Okay, I'll try and answer. First of all, I mentioned that in the in my introduction, it's the military metaphors. They are inherent in football. I mean, there's an attack, there's a defense and defender, attackers, striker. A ball is a bomb or a rocket. So it's kind of there. British or English newspaper journalists, but I'm not saying they are the only ones using it. I'm sure Germans have used that as well, but maybe not on an international stage. Maybe they are a bit more careful. Maybe they are a bit prohibited by German history. And I think in the context of an of a game between England and Germany, the British just went mad and went over the top at times to just use it. And the second part was the glorification of war, or was it, Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a debate amongst sociologists to some extent about whether the excessive use of the war metaphor either actually glorifies war or whether it trivializes war in a sense. And those are not necessarily mutually exclusive things, but I'm sort of curious if your work raises any perspective on that.
For the British, sport used to serve a purpose, and there was a saying that the empire was won on the playing fields of Eton and whatever public school you want to add to that. So it was the mindset of in the 19th century that sport actually made people physically fit for the purpose of creating the empire and maintaining it, more importantly, and keep the empire as it is, as big, as powerful as it is. Sport
wasn't the audio settings.
And in that way, the British can be accused of misusing sport for the first time. It's not the Germans are usually accused for misusing the Olympics and sports in general.
Mein Gott, ist das
ehrlich. General for their purposes. But the British did so as well, for in sending young men who have been to Eton, Harrow, any other public school, where they actually engaged in sport in the 19th century, and they were fit physically. That was the aim. They were physically fit and mentally healthy. They were, representatives of the British Empire in the colonies, in the dominions. And that way, it's a trivialization of sport. You're right in that respect, because by playing sport, by engaging in sport in previous forms of modern football or rugby or cricket, other sports, they were kind of prepared for war, or not for war as such, but also for armed conflict. Maybe just being soldiers in the empire and having to, wear weapons, use weapons, fight with weapons. It's kind of a soldier's training, even though it's not directly a soldier's training, but it's more or less it's a blatantly, it's a misuse of sport, to put it that way. The British were the first. Is that does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I'm sort of curious. I guess I'm curious the sort of cultural variations in it, and why do the British, why are the British more comfortable with it than the Germans? And what lessons does that have? But again, there may not be any in your particular work. It's just something I've wondered about. But I appreciate your response to your thoughts.
It's interesting. The Germans used to describe football games, international football games, as a Länderkampf, a fight between countries. And some football grounds in Germany are called Kampfbahn, which means it's a fighting arena. So it's even though they're not using the metaphors in the writing, or if they use Länderkampf in a report, then it is, but it's not. They also use it. They do use it. Now that I talk at length about it, they use Kampfbahn, Länderkampf, and in that way they use military language to describe a sporting contest. There you go. I had an idea.
That was a nice eureka moment. I like that. Anyone want to jump in? We're having technical difficulties with Daniel in Beirut. I know he'll come back. Chris Brown, you've got one. Shoot.
Okay, thanks, Peter. Hi again, Christoph. I'd just like to quickly start by saying I think it really would be unfair to characterize non-Guardian journalists as uneducated, etc. I think that probably speaks more to your political proclivities. But my question is, thinking about how we evaluate the language used by these journalists, you know, we can look at something written in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and think, oh, that seems insensitive. You know, at times in your dissertation, you use the word insensitive, and you make that judgment. At the time, were these newspapermen and the newspapers, were they receiving letters of complaint from the public, be it the national or the international public? Was that something that was happening? Was there any back and forth between what was being printed and the readership that you were able to access?
I know for sure that the Press Complaints Committee for the Euro 1996 competition, they have received numerous complaints about the coverage of the Daily Express, Daily Mirror. I think it was a few hundred complaints that they have received. How that was in previous... I had... a close look also in the letter section, because sometimes on some sports pages there were letters from the readers to the editors or to the writers, but there wasn't so much response to that. I think it's a good point. I think taking that for granted, it was more widely accepted. I know that I'm looking at it from a 21st century perspective. I consider some of those comments a bit insensitive. But you're right. Maybe at the time they were far more acceptable than they are probably now. I think so. I mean, I think so that in today, we would probably not write in a way that Desmond Hackett would write, or Peter Wilson, or maybe even Hugh McIvanne has written about sport, or Brian Glanville has at times written about football.
Could I follow up on that?
Yeah.
Did you get a sense that you touched on this earlier? Did you get a sense that these sports writers felt that what they were doing was beyond merely previewing the game or giving the match report? Were they interacting with what else was going on in the paper? Did they have a sense that what they were doing was important? And then more broadly, what was the general sense of the importance of how the England-Germany game was characterized? Is this something, you know, that we can use as a useful way to see the relationship reflected through the sports pages? Or do you have a sense, or do you think that your historical subjects had a sense that it was really important the way that they talked about Germany in anticipation of these games?
I don't know if I had a sense of how, or I didn't get the impression that these writers really thought that what they wrote about football was important for the wider readership of the paper, for someone who was just interested in economics or politics, may not have had the same interest in sport and not have read it, so could be completely oblivious to it. At the same time, someone who reads the football pages might not be interested in, because that's why there's a proverb that some people read the newspaper from the back page, starting with the sport and finishing with the politics last, because that's how they weigh the importance of football over politics, economics, other interests. What was the second part of your question?
Hello?
Daniel.
Yeah, thanks, Christoph. Yeah, I think you've covered the main points there, and it's certainly food for thought.
Okay, cheers.
I think we have Daniel back, if he can hear us. He seems to be on the call. Anyone else want to step in now? We are at the 45-minute mark. Could start with the second round. Anyone? Or second half?
May I, Peter?
Go for it, Stephen.
Christoph,
yeah.
Do you intend to actually turn your dissertation into a scholarly manuscript? This is it's a twofold question, A. And B, if you do, would you extend your study maybe with a new chapter about the changing relationship between England and Germany? Because I think that it has improved maybe a little bit over the course of the last decade.
Yes, Stephen, I would like to turn this into a book. And I'm sure that if I find a publisher, that I would have to extend into the new millennium, particularly to include the games at the European Championship 2000, where England beat Germany in a competitive game for the first time in 32 years. The last game in the old Wembley Stadium that Germany won in 2000 again. And then, of course, the 5-1 and even Heskey scored in Munich in 2001. I think these games would have to be included if I should. If I have the chance, if I find a publisher who agrees to turn this into a book, then of course you should add the 2010 World Cup with the goal that was not given, which kind of turns the whole history of Anglo-German football.
Well, that was a payback for the 66, let's put it
yeah,
that way.
Yeah, that was, it turns the whole thing around completely on its head. And, yeah, and these four games alone since 1996, they are worthy to be added in a chapter, should this be turned into a book, this thesis. Yeah, certainly, yeah.
I think there was a story by Simon Cooper in which he talked about the German national team. The German national team. I could be wrong. It could be another story. Actually, I mentioned this in the messages before. He kind of said that Germany. He kind of compared Germany to ugly winners up until probably the 90s, and he was talking about their transformation into kind of beautiful losers. And I think that was related to the World Cup in Germany in 2006. Any comment on that, on kind of like the changing side of the German national team? Probably it started with Klinsmann. It was actually transformed after that by Yogi Löw.
Yeah. Simon Cooper has used a figure from Star Wars, he called the Labour Germany as the Darth Vader of football.
That's right. So it was by him, yeah?
Yeah, and since 2000, 2001, they are no longer, because they have learned the hard way to lose, really. They lost against England a lot. They had a shambolic European Championship 2004. They had a good World Cup in 2006, but they lost essentially. They lost. Yeah, they turned into Holland almost. The way they lost, they played well. They surprised everyone by the way they played until 2012. They played good football. It was a very different brand of football than it has been before. there was even a criticism in Germany that the German national team has just turned into that, a beautiful loser, that that the Germans have become almost lazy and not striving for the ultimate goal, that which is a major trophy at the European Championship or the World Cup that they have. That they are rather playing well than winning anything. And I think they have they've shown that they can actually still win ugly by in the World Cup last year by in the game against Algeria, which was more than they were close to being kicked out of the tournament. They were with the back to the wall and they still got through. They somehow managed to get the goal. It's a kind of return to their ugly winning days in the 80s and 90s, early 90s, particularly the 1982 World Cup, where they were just extraordinarily ugly how the way they played, particularly the France game. But so 30 years later, they return to that era briefly to win a World Cup and to disprove some press critics, press writers, sports journalists who accused them of playing nice and beautiful but not winning anything, not having the mentality to win anything, but rather their focus was on playing beautiful football and letting the others win.
Thank you, Christoph. Very interesting comment.
Someone like to follow that up? We've lost a couple of members for various reasons, not all technological. Some had class to teach and so on and so forth. Well, if no one's in the queue, then maybe I'll ask another question, Christoph. Again, I really enjoyed reading this. I read it cover to cover, so to speak, even though I read it on my iPad. And it seemed to me that you did a wonderful job in showing how the changing contexts, you know, of the immediate post-war period versus, say, you know, the end of the Cold War affected, or the rise of Thatcherism affected, the changing nature of the coverage. But I was at times wanting you to go a little more into depth on the English side and explore a few things that, for example, David Goldblatt got into in quite some detail in his new book on English football in the era of the Premier League. For example, you know, David Goldblatt mentions pages 227, 228 of his book on how in 1966 at that final against West Germany, if you looked in the stands at Wembley, almost all the flags were Union Jacks. Yeah. And all the publicity material, all the programs he writes had the Union Jack everywhere, right? And you didn't see St. George's Cross, let alone the St. George's flag, almost anywhere. Now you fast forward to 1996, and he says on the next page, Goldblatt, that the situation had been almost completely reversed. At Wembley for that Germany-England game, you looked into the stands, and there was St. George's Cross everywhere. Homemade banners and face paint were red and white, but rarely blue. The Union Jack, you know, had almost completely disappeared. This suggests a very much a different notion of Englishness and different ways of representing the nation within football. And I wonder how this might have affected the kind of coverage that you so carefully went over in such detail in terms of representations of Germany and Germans and so on.
I think that the situation in the UK played a major part in that the Union Jack was less seen in Wembley in 1996 than in 1966. in 1966, the British Empire was about to dissolve. I think in 1966, the last country, I think Ghana was gaining its independence from the British Empire. And 30 years on, there was the Welsh had their own national assembly. The Scottish had there was did the Scottish already have their own parliament then? I'm not sure, but what I'm trying to say is that the UK was there was a process about devolution of devolution going on in the UK, and the other nations in the UK that's Northern Ireland, Wales, and Scotland had or expressed their own national identity with their flag, through their flag. Wales had is a particular case because they are not so strong in football, but rather rugby, and that is their stronghold. But with Scotland and England, that is another rivalry in football. And I suppose in the in that process of devolution that set in the 70s, the Union Jack was not seen by many English as the national flag for Great Britain, but rather seen as a flag for the St. George's Cross was then considered rather the symbol of Britain, whereas it's not correct. I think this is a different. This is a matter of perspective from Scotland and England, that these there was a evolving national identity, national pride, so to say, of Scotland that probably pushed the Union Jack in the, out of the football stadiums when England played, and there were more St. George's crosses than there were Union Jacks. You asked about in relation to Germany. Did you do that as well, Peter?
Yes. Did it affect the way that the English media covered Germany? I mean, because you did such a nice job explaining why the fear of a unified Germany did affect the language of the coverage and the metaphors and the discourses. So I was just curious if these internal dynamics might have influenced that coverage as well.
I'm sure it has. I'm sure it has. But in the case of Germany, I think the influence was from the fact that Germany was then no longer West Germany and East Germany, but one big country, and France and Britain were thinking that actually history might repeat itself. Whereas this wasn't the case. Germany had no intention to return to the thinking of the German Empire of the late 19th century, early 20th century, when it aspired to establish an empire with colonies in Africa and was a direct rival to England, to the British Empire. And they certainly didn't want to emulate the Third Reich from 1933 to 1945. So they had rather muted, I want to say, in representing themselves, even though the German national jersey had the German flag all over the place, whereas the English shirt had just the crest with three lions, and that was it. But Germany had red, black, red, yellow all over the shirt for the 1990 World Cup, for instance. Good point, actually. That's another eureka moment.
Hey, we're on a roll here. Thank you, Christoph.
Cheers.
Next question, please. I see Chris Henderson is typing. He has to attend a meeting. Oh, the bane of our existence, these awful meetings. Thanks, he says, Christoph. Okay, anyone else want to step in? Chris? Brown?
Yeah, thanks, Peter. Christoph, you discussed quite a bit and very well the question of decline for England and Britain. And I suppose this is one of the broader historical contexts that's informing what happens on the football field and, more importantly, what people are saying about it. And something I struggle with in my own work is always being very clear to separate what's happening, as far as we can tell, and what people are saying is happening. So I remember when you discussed the Suez crisis in 56, for instance, and that is obviously a great symbol of declining power of Britain and France. And you then go on, to discuss it, that it's about relative decline. But I'd really be interested to know if you could sort of summarize generally, how much does the sense of decline generally tally and follow closely the sense of decline in football for England? I know that you probably come on to this later in the dissertation from where I got to, but is it something that follows very closely the changing sense of decline on football and in general?
I think in the seven, both topic of football and decline were very close in the 1970s when England were outplayed by Germany at Wembley in 1972. And they wondered how, the English media wondered how did that happen, how could that happen. And when they later failed to qualify for the World Cup and again failed to qualify for another World Cup. And in the 70s, when Britain went through a period of, you can argue of economic this instability, when it started in the late 60s, when the pound was devalued, and then I think in the 70s there were a number of changes in government because of economic failure and... In that decade, it's decline on the football pitch and economic decline were very much interlinked or very discussed almost on a with the same importance. They were almost seen as equally important, these both topics in the discussion, in newspaper discussion, and certainly also in discussion in oral history, so to say.
Great, thanks. And my follow-up on that would be it's so hard to see all this perception of decline, and yet, as other scholars and writers have reminded us, I'm thinking of Soconomics and David Goldblatt's work. In 1956 the Suez crisis happens for Britain and France, but today in 2015 they remain UN Security Council members. And then on the footballing front, generally they're doing pretty well, and by some measurements as well as they would be expected to do. So the question of decline, I think it's a really important one for us as historians or scholars to always keep in mind as perception departs from or otherwise from what's going on the ground. But thanks very much, Okay.
Cheers.
Okay, Alex, Andrew, or Danielle, would you like to ask the next question?
Sure, I have a quick question.
Go for it.
So I've been reading a little bit here on your fourth chapter about the Falklands War and how you use it to mark kind of this reemergence of a perception of strength on the English team. So I was wondering, you talk about how this worsened Anglo-German relations, the event of the war itself, and I was curious if you could tell me, because it's outside of my patch, just how that worked, what it was about the Falklands conflict that worsened Anglo-German relations, and then if you could just tell me out of curiosity too, you know, what how was that narrative played out? Because I see you go into detail a little bit, but it's more a meta-narrative rather than kind of talking about what exactly that language was in the newspapers, and if there was is there any nuance to that narrative? Again, I'm more familiar on the Argentine side of the sources, yeah, the relationship, but I haven't read much of the English or the German for sure.
Well, the Falklands War did not really not directly affect Anglo-German relations. It was the result was that Britain showed to mostly to itself, but also to its allies, that it could still flex its muscles when necessary, even though it was a very small island, a few thousand miles away from the mother country, but it was still able to flex its muscles and keep Argentina away from the Malvinas, from the Falklands, and it initiated a nationalist discourse, or rather, a feeling that that Britain was great again. I think Britain felt great again after that. I think it is best summarized in the phrase by Margaret Thatcher after the during the war, that when she said to the TV cameras that people should rejoice. I think pardon, I don't know the exact context of it, but she said she gave a short statement about something in the conflict, and she said, "People should rejoice," and that was the end of her interview. And I think that kind of that confidence that she radiated, not just in that interview, but generally as the Iron Lady, so to say, that kind of, yeah. And of course, her close link with Rupert Murdoch once he bought the Time in 1981, that close link between politics and media. initiated a kind of renaissance of British nationalism in a more aggressive way than it was known previously. I think since 1956 they have been rather quiet. I don't know the extent of any British involvement in any conflict besides the Suez Crisis, so I might be walking on very thin ice here, but the Falklands War really marked, a renaissance, a resurgence of British nationalism, and of course it reverberated in the press, and when it was against Germany, even more so, and when it was 4 years later against Argentina, certainly even more so. But I would not put those football writers, or I would not accuse those football writers using or writing with the aim of writing nationalist articles, match reports about Germany playing England in the 82 World Cup, or I think they were just aware that there was a conflict going on, and that is reflected in their writing. If that puts your, if that answers your question.
Yeah, thanks.
Okay, Chris Brown also had to dash to class, so he's exited the pitch. But we do have Danielle back, and Andrew Guest has the next question.
I was curious, this may go back a little bit to the earlier discussion about knowing something about the journalists themselves, but I was struck by the anecdote you use to start the very beginning of the dissertation about going to England as an exchange student. I think you were in Bath, and getting comments about a recent match where the Germans got beaten handily, and reacting with interpersonal emotion and anger and sort of a feeling of personal affront. And I guess I wonder, so obviously the dissertation does a really nice job and interesting job of framing all the coverage in relation to broader social, historical, political changes. But I wonder if you also have any sense of whether some of the media representations relate to the sort of interpersonal dimension of relations between of kind of Anglo-German relations, in the sense of presuming in contemporary Europe there's a lot more opportunities to have interpersonal interactions that are not just based on, you know, the broader context of World War II or what have you. Whether that interpersonal exchange filters into the way that these are covered, or whether you think it really is about the broader political and economic context.
Okay. I actually don't know if any English sports writer had any contact with their German colleagues. I don't know. They never mention it. They would probably now in over Twitter, maybe, or in a Twitter discussion or so. But for me, walking into that employment agency, I was baffled. I was stunned how I was just looking for work, and someone came up with that line. I didn't know how to react to that, and it made me aware that in England, football had a very different was seen very differently than it was in Germany, but particularly at that time. I mean, England at that time were a very good side, and they deservedly beat a bad German side in Munich. How English and German sports journalists would act on an interpersonal basis, I don't know. Unfortunately, they have not made any remarks about that. They would probably now, as I said, on Twitter or Facebook or... but I was seriously surprised by the way of course, my accent was very strong then. And it was very easy to find out where I came from. So I guess I was just it was just obvious and easy for him to make a joke, even though he didn't know that that would offend me. Was that your question answered?
Yeah, for the most part. Even beyond direct interactions between journalists, I'm just sort of curious, broader kind of social and cultural exchanges. You know, the very fact that there are a bunch of German students moving around England and interacting, the very fact that there are, you know, presumably a lot more young English folks in Germany, whether the interpersonal dimension filters into the media coverage and sort of shapes it in a way that might interact with the broader political and economic forces, if the argument is really that it just struck me that, again, you started with sort of a personal anecdote about interaction and then move on to but then most of the coverage is really about the economic and sort of cultural dimensions of it. But it's just a point of curiosity, not anything else.
Later on in that same year in Bath, I had a remark from I played football for the Bath Spa University College football club, football team, and there was a Belgian guy or a Dutch guy who tried to wind me up just before Christmas when it was clear that Holland wasn't going to the World Cup, and he was trying to wind me up, and I tried to react funnily, but I think it came across quite rude when I asked him, well, is Holland going to the World Cup? And that ended the discussion, because obviously then they weren't going. It just made me aware that people react differently to German people that I wasn't aware, because previously I haven't been away for such a long time from home and living in a different culture, not just being on holiday, but actually living there for more than a week and immersing myself in the culture and getting to know it better. And I realized that people actually react either strongly or not so strong to your background, to where you come from, and to recent events. That struck me as that surprised me, really. Now I can laugh about it, but back then it was quite a surprise. I was the first time I was speechless.
Other questions? Alex, Daniel, you're now back. Would you like to intervene?
Yeah, sorry first for, I think I was like 25 minutes back. I was really desperate, tried 5 different devices. So sorry for sharing my frustration with these messages. I cannot remember something like this happened before. So I missed a good part, sorry. I think, Christoph, what is interesting, I don't know whether it was discussed, that, I mean, traditionally Germans had a lot of admiration, like, for like, English football, like, that they, for the atmosphere in the stadiums, but now it seems to be, like, the other way around. I mean, in England, it's like all the stadiums are, like, the prices went up and there are no standings anymore. And I read somewhere that even English fans travel to Bundesliga stadiums like Dortmund to witness like a true soccer or football atmosphere. So is this something you notice, like there's a, like that German football is like considered, or also other European leagues are considered like as something like how it used to be in England?
The Bundesliga enjoys quite a popularity in recent years, not just because of the prices, but also because the football has improved significantly over the last years, even though they're still Bayern Munich dominating the league, which makes it a bit boring. Unlike the Premier League, for instance, where still there's 3-4 teams each year that have a very good chance of winning the title, unlike in Germany, where it's not so, where the field of competitors is not so wide as it is in England. I think that makes the Premier League one of the most interesting leagues still, even though the prices are extraordinarily high. This trend started about 10 years ago after the World Cup, when Germany started suddenly play better football than they had before, and when people realised, oh, actually Germany's a nice country, so we might actually go there, and their personal experiences were very different from probably those from made by people who were there in the 80s or in the 90s or even before that. I remember from my time at school that England was considered as a very cool country, cool Britannia, because in the mid 90s that was suddenly everywhere with pop music being good, football being good again, and people went there to watch football. From my friends of mine went there to watch football and to go to concerts to listen to British music. There's a kind of admiration, even from a German side, that England is a very cool country. And it was really portrayed as cool, not as a great country, but as a cool country. Cool Britannia was the slogan that was very popular in East Germany, in my city where I come from. And I think now people in England and Britain go to German football matches because obviously the prices are cheaper, and maybe they just want to see a different culture, and because air travel is so cheap and the prices for a Bundesliga match are not as high as the Premier League or even the Championship, the second division in England, so they decide it's actually worth it going there, going not just to Germany, but maybe France, Holland, Belgium, to watch football there, which is a lot cheaper than watching the club right down your own street, because that club charges, I don't know, £50 upwards for a place high up in the stands where you can't see anything. And you have to sit and there's no atmosphere. The Germans were very concerned about having that atmosphere, and the fans agitated fought for the standing areas. And it's now probably one of the major assets the Bundesliga has in comparison to other leagues, that there's actually still one area in each stadium where people are standing and where it's absolute madness sometimes.
That's a very interesting comment. As I was trying to write some notes, something popped up here on Twitter that says, Bayern Munich fans to boycott Champions League in protest at ticket prices. This is from the worldsoccer.com website. I haven't read the piece, but certainly speaks to some of the issues that you just raised, Christoph. Okay, we have just a few minutes left. Would anyone want to make some additional comments at this point? I have a question, a kind of silly question. I took several pages of notes, and obviously I'm not going to bore everyone to tears. Maybe I'll contact you, Christoph, offline about this. I have questions about East Germany. I have questions about the new right in Britain and English club domination in Europe in the 70s. But really what I want to ask you is, do you think there'll be a thesis in the near future about press coverage related to Anglo-German women's football relations anytime soon?
Well, that would be a very interesting topic, because last year in November, about a year ago, England played Germany in a friendly in Wembley. And I had a look at the press reports before the match, and surprisingly, there was only one person using military metaphors, and that was the English coach. Anyone else, any writer in England did not use any of those metaphors, or did not use any particular phrases or yeah, not specific language that I was used to when reading through the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and 50s. It was a very, yeah, different kind of writing. In that respect, there is a thesis in there looking at it, but obviously you want to separate the women's game from the men's game. I think the contrast will always be the men's game, where metaphors have been used excessively at times. So I think there is a lot of material there, particularly now that Germany have lost to England in the third place playoff in the World Cup. Certainly there is a thesis in there from looking at the history of the women's game in England, as it was forbidden, as it was in Germany. So yeah, the current development in both countries, Germany being again a very powerful country, England probably one of the upcoming countries in the next few years. So yeah, it's definitely worth exploring it.
It seems to me that despite big events like the Women's World Cup, which we just witnessed this summer, there's not as nearly as much interest in mainstream media, at least, in the women's game. And so I'm curious, what kind of materials will be available. The sources are going to be perhaps different, certainly, you know, it does seem like the women's game is spoken in a different language almost. Yeah. And that's very interesting. And I think increasingly as England becomes stronger also in women's football vis-a-vis Germany, you know, will we see similar shifts over time from, you know, a sort of more laid back, almost perhaps condescending tone, you know, to a curious tone, to then maybe, you know, a more aggressive, more nationalistic, more chauvinistic tone, just like we saw in the men's game. Hopefully not, but it would be very, very interesting to track. Maybe one is just about at the 90th minute.
Germany and England always play extra time, very often played extra time.
We should have penalties, because then we always win.
Yeah.
I think all the Englishmen have left the conversation, so you're going to get away with that one.
It's true.
All right. Well, if there are no final comments, I'd like to thank Christoph for sharing this excellent thesis and for being so gracious in answering our questions. I get the feeling we could have gone on for even longer, but alas, the 90 minutes are over. So thanks again, and we'll reconvene the Football Scholars Forum relatively soon to discuss a chapter from Alex Galarza's own PhD thesis that he's writing on soccer clubs in Buenos Aires. So without further ado, thanks again, Christoph, and Daniel, Andrew, Alex, and everyone else who participated. We'll reconnect very, very soon.
Thanks, Peter. It was a great experience.